and welcome to the Wibbly Wobbly Timey Wimey Podcast.
I'm Lucia Kelly, expert at applied analysis and dead sweet.
And I'm Tolly Franks, media critic, fanfic enthusiast, and I create myself.
And we're here today to talk about Bad Wolf and The Parting of the Ways, the 12th and 13th episode of Series 1 of Doctor Who, the Season 1 finale! Two-parter.
Bad Wolf and The Parting of the Ways aired on the 11th and 18th of June 2005, respectively. Both episodes were written by Russell T. Davies and directed by Joe Ahearne.
Reminder that time isn't a straight line. It can twist into any shape. And as such, this is a fully spoiled podcast. We might bring in things from later in the show, the comics, the books, or even fan theories and articles.
With that out of the way, we have no weapons, no defense, and no plan. So let's get in the TARDIS.
Oh my gosh.
I'm not emotionally prepared for this.
Well, it's good that you're not emotionally prepared because the beginning of Bad Wolf is just fun. It's just a good time. Before we realize what's actually happening, this premise of the Doctor, Rose, and Jack all being thrown into very 2005 reality TV shows is so good.
It is pretty hilarious.
I love it so much.
Yeah, I gotta say, though, that Jax really hits different.
Yeah. Did you watch What Not to Wear?
Yes.
Yeah. I used to watch it pretty religiously, which is hysterical because I don't pay attention to fashion at all and never have. I just found it kind of interesting.
Well, no, I'm the fact that he ends up naked.
Yeah. I wonder if that was written in as almost an inside joke.
Yeah. And then I noticed in Boomtown, he also makes a joke about being naked.
He does, yeah.
It's gross.
Yeah. What's also gross is, why do the Trini and Susanna robots have boobs? And why do they look like that?
Yeah.
It makes me so uncomfortable. And why does Jack touch them? Can we talk about the autonomy of the robots and droids, please?
And can we talk about the fact that he then says the pleasure was all mine and that's the only thing that matters?
The thing that matters?
No.
No.
I don't like it.
I don't like it either. Why can't we have nice things? Why can't we just enjoy the 2005 nostalgia trip? Yeah. That's what I want to do.
Why did the black woman have to die?
Why did the black woman have to die?
Why did the black man have to be an asshole? Why did the South Asian woman have to be just doing her job?
Yeah.
Why did have to be white?
Yeah, and I don't know. I think we're meant to find the little sort of brewing romance between the two controllers cute. And the one time I'm on board with it is when he says, I only took the job because of you. And she snaps right back, like, what do you think just because of that? I meant to say, after all this is done, if we're both still alive, we can go out for a drink. And he comes back with, yeah. And she goes like, well, tough. And I'm like, yeah. But then she winks afterwards. And I'm like, God damn it. Because, like, I don't know. Especially because it's a white man pursuing a woman of color within the workplace.
Yep.
It just feels icky. And especially when she has expressed disinterest. And not in that, like, flirty, oh, you. Or not in the way that actually encourages. Like, I'm not about to get into all that politics about when a woman says no, she means yes, and all that kind of garbage. But there is definitely a way to do consensual, playful, will they, won't they flirting.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what she was doing. She was saying no. And then at the end, it's like, oh, she was actually saying yes this whole time. And that's such a, don't do that. Don't justify that kind of behavior. I don't like it.
Yeah, retroactively, I think it's cute because I know at the end she liked him the whole time. but looking at it through the lens of just what is actually portrayed, not knowing the end game of she liked him the whole time, it is very icky.
Yeah. So yeah, we've got all of these different reality TV shows. The Doctor's in Big Brother, which I find hysterical. Rose is on The Weakest Link and Jack's on What Not to Wear. The like peppy joy with which that voiceover, when you know what actually happens to the contestants or what is said to happen to the contestants, and it's like, and then we're gonna get you. And it's like, you mean you're gonna kill me?
Yeah. It's just wild.
It's so much. It's so much. And especially, like, they obviously, they focus on the Doctor a bit because of the three shows, Big Brother is the one that sort of works the best narratively for the twist. Like, Big Brother is overdramatic. It is overplayed. There is this sort of life and death stakes with no real danger, and then to find out no, it is real, is a really good twist.
Yeah, and also it's the one where they all get invested in each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that whole, the whole scene with the first eviction where the three contestants are so emotional and the Doctor is like, come on. Like, mm-hmm. It super works.
It definitely works. And the Doctor just looks devastated when he realizes, because Christopher Eccleston.
Yeah. Oh, Christopher Eccleston. Now that we've come to the end, I'm so, so sad.
I am so
that
sad.
That there's not more nine. He brings so much to the table, particularly all of that emotional stuff, the way that he plays the Doctor as closed off but incredibly close to the surface is such skilled work. And so beautiful.
Yeah, the way that he brushes off Linda, except when she shows that vulnerability, and then he's so, so nice. He's,
I know!
And so, so gentle with her.
Mm, poor Linda.
Yeah.
Linda with a Y. You were never long for this world. You were never gonna last.
Yeah, she was never gonna last. She was too nice.
Yeah, that whole moment where he's like, oh, I'm a traveler. It's like, oh, I could come with you. Because this whole season, we've seen these one episode characters that come in for the episode and they have an adventure with the Doctor and then the Doctor swans off. And a few times we've both said, like, oh, they would have made a great companion to stick around for a couple of episodes. The ones that are sticking out to me are both Dickens and Nancy. Would have been super fun to just have them stick around. Linda is not one of those. They do a great job of showing how Linda would not be good companion material while still being like, she's a good person and she's sweet, but she doesn't make the cut.
I feel like I didn't want Linda to be a companion, but I wanted her to have a nice little vacation. I wanted her to see the stars. I wanted her to have a nice Doctor Who experience.
You know, those are few and far between.
It doesn't when has any, want it when for her.
When has any companion walked away from the Doctor, if they do, with less trauma than when they started off? Is there one?
I would argue that some of the book companions.
Right.
Well, actually, no, I would argue, what's her name? Christina D'Souza from Planet of the Dead ends up,
all right, yeah,
her off at the end of the episode. She has a flying bus.
She does have a flying bus. There's a character I would love to see again. We never ever will. Do you know what? She and Jenny found each other in the stars and they're off having their own adventures.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%.
If you're not going to write them into canon, we will. So everyone finds out that, oh, wait, hang on a moment. This is real stakes. And so it's a rush to make sure that everyone gets back together again. We find out that they were pulled out of the TARDIS, which is pretty powerful tech.
The controller is wildly powerful. Wildly.
Yeah. The controller is a very interesting character. visually just arresting, both the way the lighting where she's plugged in, and then I love the switch that happens in terms of how we perceive her and how she's framed and how she's viewed when she gets transported to the Dalek ship.
Mm-hmm.
And we see just how alien she looks.
Mm-hmm.
In the original sense of that term, like uncanny almost. She just looks outside of the world.
Yeah, it reminds me of what the white guy controller was saying, that he thinks she hasn't been human for years.
Mm. But for goodness sake, my darling, my doll, just give a keyword. When the doctor's like, just tell me their name, tell me their name, tell me something to identify them by. And she's like, can't, it's locked away. Do you know what you could say? You could say they exterminate. Hmm. You could say literally any keyword that's, hey, it's about the Daleks. You could say the blue eye. You could do anything, anything at all. But then, of course, we wouldn't get the awesome reveal. I love the way that they reveal that the Daleks are behind this. So first we get the visual of looking through the eye stalk at Rose, and then the mirrored reflection of the Daleks behind the controller in her final moments. Just perfect. Beautiful. I love it.
Okay, we need to take a second to recognize that I looked at the transcript. Because
mm-hmm.
we were talking last episode how we didn't know between the two of us what the names of the two floor controllers were. And I said, oh, well, they introduced themselves at one point. But I realized only the male controller introduces himself. Because I looked up the transcript, and in the transcript, he's listed as being Pavel, but the other controller is just listed as being woman.
Yeah.
Throughout the entire transcript. So she never gets the name.
I hate this.
Why does the white guy get a name?
Why does the white guy get a name? So Rose, quote unquote, dies. And this is where the episode flips, right? Like, we've had the threat of death. And of course, we've got Roderick, who's the worst.
The absolute worst. Mm. We discussed how they like making black people and other POC the absolute worst.
Yeah. So all these extras are dying. They finally make their way into Rose's weakest link room, and just as she's running towards them, she gets blasted by the android's ray and apparently disintegrates. The crew get arrested.
I'm wondering, if she is transmatting, where is the powder coming from?
I thought that it was the dust that settles on the body. If you're transmitted, you're taking just the person and their clothes. So anything else that's sort of around the body. But even then, it might even be that in order to perpetuate the fantasy that this is a disintegration ray, the Daleks have somehow built into it that a deposit is left.
Weird, but okay.
Yeah, it's one of those, and the science works how? Question marks.
I think this episode is going to get a low science grade.
Oh, it's going to get such a low science grade because we haven't even gotten to the finale yet, but we will get there when we get there. There's this whole montage where everything's silent. The dialogue fades out. We focus on the doctor's face. Christopher Eccleston kills us all slowly with his looks of grief and devastation mm-hmm. and guilt.
Can we really just be acting a six, honestly?
Jack and the doctor demonstrate the very important life lesson of don't talk to cops. And then without any communication at all, they break out.
It's because they vibe so well with each other. They are in love.
And they Thruple is missing their third piece.
Yeah, but they know how to do this because they've clearly done this before.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Also, more proof that Jack and the doctor and just how close that group is, Jack has a key. So we know how much a bigger deal it was when Rose got the key.
Oh, it's a very big deal. It's a very big deal whenever a companion gets a key.
I'm upset we didn't get to see that. Get to see Jack being given the key. Because I think especially in this episode and the next, we see just how much Jack has grown as a result of being with the Doctor and being with Rose. What I did find... It's not funny, but it kind of is. Rose's jacket being left on the sort of coral banister. That is a visual cue that we are going to see again. So clearly Rose doesn't put her clothes away.
Yeah, no, I noted that too, but I thought it was so interesting, the differences in how that visual cue is treated.
Say more.
Well, I think it happens more than once, but the two that I was thinking of are when Jack does it here and Donna's reaction when she sees it, because she has a very different reaction to seeing another woman's clothing strewn about the TARDIS.
Well, well, yeah, because in The Runaway Bride, right, we get both the Doctor and Donna have time to respond. So we get the Doctor's response first, which is devastating. And then because he literally can't deal with the grief, he puts it back exactly where it was.
Mm-hmm.
So that it is then set up for the comedic take.
Yeah, no, I definitely saw the connection between the Doctor's reaction and Jack's reaction because, again, Thruple, they're both in love with her. But because the Doctor and Jack's reaction and that visual repetition feels obvious to me, I was thinking in particular of how Donna's take is so different. But I'm also thinking of how the Doctor and Jack are so willing to sacrifice their lives because they know Rose is safe. And I'm just like, the Thruple energy. The Thruple energy is there, but also the toxic masculinity aspect of it too.
Yeah, the damseling of Rose is starting to really bug me.
Mm-hmm.
It's been an issue pretty much from the beginning, but particularly in these last three episodes, Boomtown, Bad Wolf, and The Parting of the Ways. What bothers me most about Rose is that she's got a really solid foundation as a great companion. And even a solid foundation as a morally complex and interesting companion. Like, I feel like there are two different versions of Rose, depending on how you feel about her. And she's either the best and so sweet, so compassionate, so everything. Or she's this horrible bitch who left Mickey on the line and never takes personal responsibility for her own actions. That's the same person, but she's not given the time to be complex.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, what's happening is that we're just consistently minimizing her characterization in order to damsel her so the Doctor and any other male companions can come and rescue her.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why I find the inclusion of Linda so interesting, because the look Rose gives her when they're in the control room together and the Doctor says, this is your role, good luck. And there's that little bit of back and forth between Linda and the Doctor. Rose gives Linda a look of such venom, which is so unwarranted and very much feels like, excuse me, the role of damsel has already been fulfilled. Back off. Like,
really?
Oh yeah,
it didn't seem like venom to me. It seemed more like pity.
Interesting.
But it was really sort of pitying, disgust, hate to be her sort of look.
Interesting.
Almost like she was looking down on her.
Oh yeah, definitely. I definitely think that Rose looks down and pities Linda.
I think she was looking at her kind of like, oh, he's not interested. I think she's secure enough in how much the Doctor's interested in her that she knows, or thinks she knows, that the Doctor's interest in Linda is superficial. I don't think the Doctor's interest in Linda is actually superficial, but I think she thinks that.
Okay, let's have this conversation. The Doctor and attraction. So throughout this whole series, throughout all of season one, we've kind of been teasing at Rose and the Doctor. We haven't really been able to go full-fledged romance because Mickey exists and they've made that choice. But also because, well, first of all, it's season one of the revival. And I can assure you there was no canoodling in Old Who. That wasn't the dynamic. And I kind of hate that it's become an aspect in New Who. It introduces this really complicated and unexamined power dynamic between the Doctor and the companions that is not a part of being in a healthy relationship and affects all of the relationships that the new Doctor has with the new companions. And I think that's present with Rose. I think it's present with Linda. It's definitely present with Martha. And even after we have the break with Donna, where we explicitly say, no, they're best friends and this is all it is. We'll get into it, but I found his relationship with Amy very odd. And Clara is a whole other thing.
I mean, I think that they do a really good job with Clara and 12.
But Clara and 11 are a problem.
Clara and 11 are a problem, but Clara and 11, I prefer to pretend don't exist.
And given we're already on this topic, I want to talk about this kiss. The 10th Doctor starts in the wake of this highly emotional, highly charged, and not discussed relationship with Rose. Rose and the Doctor never talk about who they are to each other. They'll dance around it and they'll affirm their affection for each other, but they won't clarify or define their terms or their relationship in a way that is not beneficial to either of them. And I think a big part of that is that, like, I'm of the opinion that the regeneration is often, like, the personality of the regeneration is often built from the circumstances of the death of the last Doctor.
Absolutely. Yeah. I feel like the new Doctor is fundamentally shaped by how the old Doctor died.
So you get the 9-10 transition, and 10 is such an emotional Doctor, where 9 is often quite shielded and doesn't show emotion very freely, except when he does. He'll crack often. He's close to the surface, but he's also very guarded. 10 is just all surface all the time. And he's also, I think, textually in love with Rose.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I think that's very textual.
Absolutely.
And that kind of passionate, involved, in love with the world, in love with Rose, very heightened existence, I think is 100% born from how heightened Nine's death is. There's a direct transition there.
Can we also talk about how Rose creates herself as the bad wolf? And I'm specifically also thinking about how that connects to the 50th and the moment.
Yeah.
So what I'm wondering is, how much is it actually Rose creating herself? And how much is it potentially the moment bleeding through?
Yeah.
I'm wondering if we think about how they wrote the moment to interfere with the bad wolf, because the moment definitely builds on the bad wolf mythology.
Yeah. So let's take it from the top. First of all, the Doctor sends Rose home in possibly the most, like, this is the beginning of the heartbreak. The way that, and again, all the props to Christopher Eccleston, the way that upon second viewing, like, maybe in first viewing you buy it, but upon second viewing, the fact that the Doctor is acting is so apparent. The high energy, the way that he builds Rose up, the way that he uses their routines and the way that they work together in order to ensure that she stays in the TARDIS, and the way he just stops as soon as he's outside is just devastating.
And his face falls, and then he turns, and then he looks at the TARDIS, and then it's just, my heart cannot take this. And he's gone. And Christopher Eccleston is gone. And we're not going to have him as the Doctor anymore. I still haven't been able to bring myself to listen to the audio dramas, because I don't know if my heart can take having him again, because I want him so much. Like, once I go down that road, I'm going to be so upset that I don't have him on screen.
You can read the comics, you can listen to the audio, and you can picture it in your head. See it in your mind. So Rose comes home. Well, first of all, we have that message from the doctor, which is basically like, I am very explicitly telling you multiple times, stay put and stay home.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is the message. Have a fantastic life, right? And okay, it's a beautiful moment. There is no way on earth that the doctor would be able to record that message looking straight ahead and then know that Rose is going to be at that point for the head tilt to work. It just, it works beautifully visually. Of course I'm crying at that moment. It's a beautiful visual moment. It makes no sense subjectively.
I feel like the doctor knows Rose well enough that she wouldn't keep looking at him. That she would try to examine.
But where would she be? In the TARDIS. He doesn't know. Just indulge me for the moment of like him thinking that she's going to be where she is, but she's actually on the opposite side of the TARDIS. So he's facing away from her during that moment.
It would be hilarious.
It would be hilarious. It would break the tension. It would absolutely ruin the moment. But that's the more realistic thing if he was trying to do that. Rose comes home and par for the course, she treats Jackie and Mickey horribly. Like full petulant teenager is on display here. She is 100% about her own feelings, what she's thinking, what she knows is best. It's so hard to watch. On multiple levels. First of all, because I have 100% been that teenager. Like, that's a very real reaction, mm-hmm. which I appreciate. What I don't appreciate is that kind of behavior and that mindset, and deliberately and explicitly on purpose defying the doctor's last instruction to her is rewarded. I hate that. I hate that this safety protocol is put in place specifically to help her and to save her life. And that it's a sensible, like the point that the doctor makes about how the TARDIS should never be in the hands of the Daleks is a fucking valid point.
Mm-hmm.
It is so reckless. This is primary Gryffindor privilege behavior. This is primary Gryffindor behavior being rewarded when it's not smart. It's framed in a way that's like she's being so selfless. She's sacrificing herself for the greater good. No, she's fulfilling her fantasy of being the hero. And it's being rewarded. And I hate that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get that. At the same time, I feel like it wouldn't have worked if it wouldn't have worked. The TARDIS never would have gone against the doctor's wishes and let her go back if she wasn't given the power to fix everything.
Well, yeah, I also hate that she has to break the TARDIS. She has to damage the TARDIS in order for this to happen. I don't know if she had talked to the TARDIS, if she had had this emotional connection to the ship.
Also, it kind of breaks canon with the comics, because in the comics, the Doctor partially teaches Rose how to fly the TARDIS.
Mm. That's within the text of the TV show as well, I think, because we often see the way that he guides his companions to help him pilot the TARDIS. It just makes me so upset. And I get why. I get why they did it that way. I just wish it had been different. But yeah, so Bad Wolf.
The TARDIS gives Rose magic powers.
Yeah. So Rose has this tantrum, and then, first of all, she didn't see the huge lettuce across the fields that take up a third of the field. So they go through this whole rigmarole because she's been given a message that Bad Wolf is a connection to the Doctor. And she pulls the TARDIS apart and she takes in time essence. She looks into the eye of the vortex and, like, yes, gains powers.
So what I think, and this is why I bring up the moment, I think that, and bear with me here, I think this isn't what was happening in season one. In season one, it was just magical garbage. But I think, in my retroactive opinion, is that Rose looked into the time vortex and imbibed the power of the moment.
Okay. Because remind me, it's been a minute since I've watched the 50th. Is there,
because the thing is
a reason,
the thing is the moment has the power to destroy entire planets. It canonically has the power to destroy entire planets,
yeah,
and unwrite things.
Yeah. Is there any context given for the phrase Bad Wolf?
The context
from the moment?
The context, yeah. So here, I'll pull up.
Because that was another thing that bothered me, is that there is no inciting incident or circumstance for that phrase. And this is the thing with time travel and time travel loops, which kind of is something that often you come up against when you're writing this kind of fiction, is like the idea of the self-contained time loop and how that doesn't work.
Yeah, so basically what happens is the moment says in the 50th, says, "I hear you, all of you jangling around in that dusty old head of yours. I chose this face and form especially for you. It's from your past or possibly your future. I always get those two mixed up." The warrior doctor says, "I don't have a future." The moment says, "I think I'm called Rose Tyler. No, yes, no, sorry, no, no. In this form, I'm called the Bad Wolf."
Right. So there's still no actual context given to that phrase. It's just that the term Bad Wolf sounded cool and Russell T. Davies was, "This sounds fun." There's no actual in context reason.
Because the thing is, the Bad Wolf creates itself. The Bad Wolf sees the words Bad Wolf and decides to spread it around.
That doesn't make sense, Talia. There has to be a chicken or an egg. And yeah, the magic powers. She can disintegrate Daleks on sight. She brings Jack back to life permanently.
Permanently.
That boy will never die. He's not allowed. Oh, which is reminding me of one of my favorite Doctor Who short stories, which is when, I can't remember what it's called, either the book or the short story, which I know is so helpful, but it's Jack is in, I think, 18th century England, and there's a boy who basically has some aspect to the Rift. Like, he's basically like Gwyneth. He has some aspect to ESP. So when people ask him questions, he just sort of automatically knows the answer. And he's been turned into kind of a sideshow freak show because of this. And then basically it's all about how this boy is in an awful situation because he's like being held against his will and all this sort of stuff. It's about how Jack kind of saves him. But the question he asks is, how am I going to die? And the boy says, I don't know. Like, I can't answer that. It's beyond time. And just,
That is rough, buddy.
It's rough. And this is where Jack is like basically kind of one of his lowest points in his depression cycle as well. It's like 18th century Victorian noir with Jack as the like jaded detective character who's trying to save what's left of this corrupted world.
I was feeling so happy and peaceful, and now I want to cry again.
You're talking to me about fiction. What how did you think this was going to end?
I need more tea.
Don't worry, I'm dead sweet. So the rose. So Rose imbibes the magical time essence. Mickey and Jackie get left behind. Rose comes back to the future. She disintegrates all the Daleks. She brings Jack back to life forever. And then the Doctor kisses her to transfer the time essence, uwu magic powers to him instead. And I ask, why? Who knows? Like, I don't see why, like, a hug or, like, any kind of touch would have worked just as well. There's no reason for there to be a kiss there, apart from the fact that they want there to be this complicated, weird romantic relationship between the Doctor and Rose.
Speaking of kissing, can we talk about the fact that we see Rose's reaction to being kissed by Jack, but not the Doctor's?
Uh-huh. We sure can. Yeah, let's avoid talking about that whole end scene that makes me so upset and mad. I'm pretty sure we get confirmation of our thruple here.
Uh-huh.
I'm pretty sure, like, Jack's been doing a lot of work with Rose off screen, unpacking her homophobia and introducing her to the idea of a thruple and opening her mind to the possibilities. The Doctor was always up for it.
Doctor was always on. Of course he wants to dance. Who with?
Yeah. I do love the fact that like that whole scene is so gorgeous. And this is what I'm talking about where we see Jack's growth. Like the seriousness with which he sort of holds Rose down and says, like, you are worth fighting for, and like kisses her and goes straight to the Doctor and does the same. And his command of the volunteers, how he stands up to the Daleks, fights to his last breath. Like, we really see just how much being with the Doctor has affected how he thinks about life.
Yeah.
And how he wants to greet it.
Also, I was going to say, the Daleks themselves just menacing onwards in the way that they let themselves get shot at but just move forwards, not killing people until the last moment, and just the way that they just play with people is so fucked up, and I love it and I hate it. I love the characterization and I hate the way it affects the characters. And
oh yeah, the moment where you see when the Doctor and Jack and Rose are first on the ship, and like you see that real anger from the Doctor and how traumatic this is for him, the moment with him, it's so clear, the visual language when he is back on the inside of the TARDIS and just leaning against the doors.
Oh my goodness.
And you get that like very slow close up as you hear the Daleks, and you know that he is having war flashbacks. Like,
mm-hmm.
It's just done so well. And the kind of conversations that he and the Emperor Dalek have,
I just,
are excellent as well.
I'm actually crying right now. It's just, it's so tense, and it's so, I need another tissue. Oh, sorry. Did I forget to mute myself that time?
No, I want you to keep that in so people can know the true depth of your pain.
I've been muting myself every time that I blow my nose from crying. Because I don't want to interrupt the podcast. That's why I've been letting you talk this whole episode. I've been too busy crying in the background. This episode is just going to be Lucia, like, unpacking the whole episode and Talia slowly weeping.
Yes, let me take you on this path of devastation. Let me make this sad episode even sadder in your head.
I'm just so devastated, both by the episode, by Eccleston leaving, by Jack being left behind, the look of sad disgust on his face.
I want to discuss this. Do you think in the moment that the Doctor knew, because we the audience, see Jack being brought back to life. The Doctor didn't see that. He sees Rose being super stressed out and breaking apart at the seams as she like dramatically monologues and disintegrates Daleks.
I think when she says, "I bring life," I think he knows what she did, because he says in season 3 that he deliberately left Jack there.
Because like the way that the episode plays out, I could 100% see him just being like overwhelmed in the moment, being like, there is too many things going on here. Something's got to give, and that thing is Jack.
Because
also the thing is, and I think he does bring this up in season 3 as well, Jack's not completely helpless. He does have his own transport. It's not like he's not leaving him on a deserted island with nothing but a coconut and a pistol. Like, he does have some options.
Mm-hmm.
It's a shitty thing to do. Another, in terms of, again, just spot on direction, a moment that I always, and I know this is a very me moment to love, but the moment when Linda dies, like just before, and you see the Daleks rising up.
No, Lucia, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with you?
But the moment when we see the Daleks rising, so like we're focusing on the door, everyone's focusing on the door, being like, oh my gosh, are they going to get through the door? The Daleks rise up behind her. And because there's no sound in space, we don't hear them say exterminate, but we see the lights flashing in time. That is so cool. That's so good.
What's wrong with you?
Excellent world building.
I've never identified with Imani Moore in my life. For the first time and said, what's wrong with you? Because what's wrong with you? Why is that your favorite moment?
I don't know. It's the
get on the feeling right now. You're benched. You're benched right now. Get over there. Go.
I don't know. It's the film student in me. I'm just like, oh, that's so good. That's such brilliant world building and like visual storytelling. And yes, let's use the real world rules. Love it. And so I can never give Linda her moment of like respectful peace because I'm always just being like, the production design. I'm sorry. I'm a very broken, bad person.
I'm just going to cry. I'm going to cry now.
So, do we want to talk about the ethics of the Delta Wave and that whole dilemma?
It's the time war all over again.
Yeah, I find it interesting that the doctor is framed as being pushed towards genocide quite often for a character we are meant to respect and admire. This happens multiple times. It's ironically using remarkably similar sort of thought processing and justification that the phrase, I'm just doing my job, brings to mind.
Not really.
You don't reckon?
I feel like the phrase just doing my job implies that someone higher up is pulling the strings, and someone who says I'm just doing my job has no power, has no like true choice. Like someone who's just doing their job feels like they're a cog in the machine, whereas someone like the doctor is deciding whether or not the machine is running.
I guess I hadn't fully considered the hierarchical nature of that phrase. However, at the same time, there are plenty of people who leave their jobs when they find them morally abhorrent.
Yeah, no.
And I understand that there can be many outside circumstances, but there are always ways to resist. And I have always viewed the phrase, I was just doing my job, as a way people justify inaction.
Oh, it's definitely a way people justify inaction. But I'm saying the doctor's not doing inaction. He is actively choosing to do something.
But do you think that the doctor, views quote unquote saving humanity, saving the day as his job? That's his role within the universe. Yes. And so these big decisions.
He says that explicitly in World War III. He says, this is my life, Jackie. It's not fun. It's not smart. It's just standing up and making a decision because nobody else will.
Mm.
And it's this doctor that says that.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because he often doesn't make the decision. He waits until the absolute last minute to make the decision because he's just waiting for someone else to make the decision for him.
Yeah, yeah. The doctor's inaction and how that leads to extreme action is definitely something I want to watch for going forward, because I think it's a pattern that he tends to use a lot.
I'm going to say it comes up in one of my absolute least favorite episodes. It's in season 8 with Capaldi, so you haven't seen it. And basically, the doctor forces Clara to make that decision.
Ooh.
Yeah, he basically says that I haven't seen this episode in forever because I hate it, so I try not to rewatch it if I can. But if I'm remembering correctly, he forces Clara to make the decision because he says that he's not a human, so it's not his choice to make, so he forces her to make it.
Cannot wait for that episode. That's gonna be fun. Yeah. So I think we'll keep an eye out for the way that the doctor deals with big problems and sort of put a pin in it, because it definitely seems to be a pattern with him that he seems to like waver between always on the move, always acting, always trying to save, always trying to improve the world in some way. And then in many ways, actually similar to Rose, in that sort of like big picture, big picture, big picture, can't think about it, don't want to think about it, and using other people's distress as a way to distract from the problems in their own life.
Mm-hmm.
But that, unfortunately, is a dilemma that Christopher Eccleston will not be solving for us, because it is time to say goodbye.
He was fantastic.
He was fantastic. He
was so fantastic.
We will miss him. He has done an absolutely phenomenal job. He had such a huge ask to bring back this iconic character and to be the face of that character, right? The very first new Doctor was such enormous shoes to fill.
And he filled them.
Absolutely. Just to their very limit. In fact, I think he might have found those shoes a bit small, which is remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
And we say goodbye to Mr. Eccleston. And hello to Mr. Tennant. And he's so baby.
Isn't
he's David so Tennant small?
I believe he is. Isn't he Sir Tennant? I thought he was a sir.
Hang on. David Tennant, knighthood. Nope.
No, he's just a sir in the episode. I'm thinking of...
He's just a sir in the episode.
I'm thinking of the Doctor.
David Tennant is so baby in this. Like, even in this brief little moment. Like, his little freckles. He's 35, which is wild to me. He looks so much younger.
Okay.
He was 35, possibly 34 at the time of filming this.
All right. Not to diverge from David Tennant too much, but so skip ahead of Dr. Matt Smith when he started Doctor Who in 2010. So when he filmed his first appearance in 2009, he was only 26.
No! That's not allowed!
Sorry, I just wanted to freak you out.
No!
I just felt like freaking you out a little bit. Because when it aired...
Don't remind me of how much I need to do in order to...
Hey, age. I was shook when I remembered that when he filmed that, because the end of time, David ended his doctorhood in the new years of 2009, 2010. And Matt Smith's birthday is in October and he was born in 1982, which means that when he like filmed his first bits of Doctor Who, he was only 26. We're old, Lucia.
No. Matt Smith is freakishly young. This is the way we frame it. No.
So Matt Smith has a genuine baby face. But David Tennant.
Matt Smith is genuine baby.
Yeah, Matt Smith is a genuine baby. David Tennant
has
a baby face.
I've talked about my favorite moment. What was your favorite moment?
Let me look at my notes again. I think it was probably the thruple moment where Jack kisses Rose and the Doctor in the exact same way. Because while I think there's a lot of problematic stuff about the age differences in their relationship, I really ship the thruffle a lot. Like, I like to pretend in my brain that Rose is the age of Billy Piper, which is like 25, and that Jack is the age that John Barrowman looks, which is, I don't know how old John Barrowman is in this episode, but he looks like he's late 20s.
I love that. It's not about the actual age, it's about the vibes.
Yeah, well, it's because like this show is like very, we don't care anything about the actors other than their acting skill. Like,
yeah,
we establish that like we care that the actors are good at acting, because they are. Acting gets a 5 out of 5 every single episode. We've established this. I looked at the spreadsheet. Like, we should just pre-fill 5 in every trick. How old the actors are doesn't really matter to me.
I will say, and we'll address this more in the next episode, The Christmas Invasion, I love the way that they address and explain regeneration, especially this first time when everyone's confused and stressed.
The way that he explains it to Clara is trash. I feel so bad for Clara.
But this first time is fine. Yeah, the way he talks about just the way that he reassures Rose and the way that his last moments with her, affirming her, and affirming his love for her, whatever kind of love that is. He is trying to use this extremely stressful moment to keep Rose calm and informed.
Mm-hmm.
Is a really high form of love.
Mm-hmm.
That I adore.
You're gonna make me cry again.
That's my other favorite moment. Are you happy? I chose an appropriate favorite moment.
Yeah. I mean, that is also my other favorite moment. I would say probably my least favorite moment is when Rose tells Mickey that there's nothing left for her there. So I would say I hate that she says that, but I do love his reaction, which is just,
yeah,
right. Okay. If you really believe that, then I'll help you. Because he's a real one.
He is. Like,
they say Mickey the idiot, they say that he's useless or whatever, but no, he's a real one.
The way that Rose treats Jackie and Mickey in this episode is atrocious. It's just awful. Especially when they're helping her.
Mm.
And like trying their best and comforting her, and like she's in this moment of extreme distress. Like, we talk way back in episode one. We talked about how Rose is meant to be 19, and it feels like a lot of the time the writers forget that because Billy Piper is very clearly 25.
Mm-hmm. But I feel like
this to me felt 19.
Like, it definitely felt
19. She was feeling all 19 years of that. And Rose is lucky that Mickey and Jackie love her, is all I'm saying.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, no, my least favorite moment is Jackie and Rose in the TARDIS talking about her dad.
Yeah.
I hate that Rose uses that against her.
Mm-hmm.
I hate the manipulation. I hate the fact that Jackie walks away from that conversation and comes to the conclusion that Rose is right. And it feels like a concession.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just terrible. And to that end, who are your hero and Adam?
I feel like my hero is Jack and my Adam is Roderick. We knew he was going to be the Adam. We knew he was going to be the Adam all along. I said it last episode that he was going to
be. Yeah.
I think we got so caught up in the feels that we forgot he existed, but he was definitely the Adam.
Yeah. Yeah. Rose was running for second place for a minute there, but Roderick took the gold. or failed to take the gold, as the case may be.
Yeah.
Poor guy. He just wanted to take his money and run, and no one would let him. For me, the hero is the doctor.
I guess the hero is the doctor. I was thinking, yeah, you're right. The hero is the doctor. I was thinking of how Jack sacrifices himself and genuinely sacrifices himself.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the doctor knows he's going to be okay, even if he's not himself. Jack genuinely thinks he's going to be dead, and he gives up the loves of his life and comes to peace with the fact that the entire world is going to be destroyed.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing saying we can't have, we've had the same hero in Adam for a while, but there's nothing saying that we can't have different heroes in Adams.
Like, I also love the doctor. I feel like the doctor is definitely, I can definitely see the doctor as the hero, and I want to make him the hero because it's the last time that he's here. I'm like honestly torn about whether or not making the doctor or Jack the hero or the Adam, the hero or the hero. Roderick's definitely the Adam. But I'm torn about whether or not to make the doctor or Jack the hero. I feel like I also kind of want to give it to Jack just because the doctor abandons Jack. I don't want to give it to Jack
as a consolation prize.
Not as a consolation, but because I dislike the doctor for abandoning Jack. Like, it's not a consolation for Jack. It's a demerit for the doctor.
The doctor abandoned you. Have this shiny medal. Yeah, the conversations around both Jack and the doctor about cowardice in this episode is, I think coward is a very loaded word.
Mm-hmm.
And I love where Jack comes down on Coward. I don't like where the Doctor comes down on Coward.
Me either.
Like, I feel like Jack and the Doctor have different definitions of the word coward. And I agree far more with Jack's interpretation than the Doctor's.
I don't think the Doctor actually believes in that definition of coward. That's not the Doctor's definition of coward. That's the Doctor answering the Daleks' question. Like, the Doctor's not saying, I'm a coward. The Emperor says, what are you, a coward or a killer? And the Doctor says, coward, any day. So he's not saying that, yes, this is my full definition of coward. He's just answering, it's a yes or no question. So he's saying, like, I'd rather be a coward than a killer, is what he's saying. He's not saying that this is what I believe a coward to be. In my perception, the Doctor's not saying this is cowardice. He's saying, I won't be a killer.
Yeah, I think definition of coward is also something we should keep an eye on going forward, because, and tying it back to this idea of the next Doctor is born directly out of the situations in which the last Doctor died, I think a lot of 10 is characterized and defined by self-loathing, which is a very interesting trait to give someone who is so outwardly loving, and very much where I think the Doctor is at, the ninth Doctor is at the point of his regeneration, in terms of how he thinks about himself and how he thinks about himself specifically in the context of the Time War and what he did.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very much worth noting that 9 and 10 are the two Doctors who think that the Time Lords are all dead.
Yeah.
And who let it affect them.
Yeah.
11.
Eleven
lets it affect him, but not on the surface.
I have thoughts about how the Schrodinger's cat of the whole, did the Time War happen? Are the Time Lords dead? That whole situation that they decide to just kind of... like, take back, like, they make, like I was saying in episode 2, I think it's such a ballsy move to say, you know what, yeah, the Doctor committed mass genocide, including against his own people, and all the Time Lords are dead. That is a crazy ballsy move. The fact that they then walk it back 3 years later, I have opinions.
I think it's actually 7 years later.
7 years later. Three Doctors later.
but I mean, then what they do 7 years after that with the Timeless Children is interesting. I mean, you know about the Timeless Children, right?
I do. I've absorbed some knowledge through osmosis. But that's all ahead of us. That's all ahead of us. This is the end of season 1. We've had a marvelous ride.
All right. Shall we do the...
Let's get to grading.
Production?
5. 5,
yeah. Writing?
Possibly also 5. Maybe 4.
I think it's a 5.
Acting 5, we know this.
Science?
This is where it all falls down. The science is really questionable. I hadn't even thought about what you brought up earlier with the ray. The fact that the ray doesn't make sense once you know what it actually does. Yeah.
Is there anything about the science that does make sense? Is my question. I was about to say, let's give it a 2, but then I was like, wait a minute, that's a bit arbitrary. And also, what is there about the science that makes sense?
I mean, even the idea of Daleks building themselves from the cells of humans.
I mean, that's also something to keep track of, is the Daleks have an interesting habit of blending with humans.
Yeah. Isn't it just fascinating how these perpetuators of racial purity can't actually exist in the vacuum they crave?
Mm-hmm.
And always use and abuse creatures that they view as lesser than. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, isn't it we didn't even get to all the religious overtones with that, but I think we're running a little low on time.
I'm not sure any of the science makes sense. Like, even using the controller as a human processor.
They come back to that in, like, season 12, about using people as human processors.
I refuse to... I know we humans in the 21st century have not yet built a computer to match the complexities and capabilities of the human brain. I refuse to believe that the Daleks have not. I could buy them using a human as a way of degrading them and dehumanizing them.
Literally.
Literally, yeah. I don't buy that that's their only path.
Well, maybe they just literally wanted to do it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we have to give science a zero, unfortunately. Rewatchability is a 5, though.
Rewatchability is a 5, straight up.
At least this makes the math easy.
It's 80%, which is a solid B minus, which feels right. An absolutely solid B minus of an episode and a beautiful, gorgeous send-off for Christopher Eccleston.
This has been the Wibbly Wobbly Timey Wimey Podcast.
We hope you enjoyed this adventure with us through space and time.
You can find us elsewhere on the internet, on Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram as @WibblyPod. Follow us for more Wibbly Wobbly content.
You can find out more information about us and our content on wibblywobblytimeywimey.net and full transcripts for episodes at wibblywobblytimeywimey.net/transcripts.
If you'd like to get in touch, you can send us an email at wibblywobblytimeywimeypod@gmail.com.
Please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and other platforms as it helps other people find us and our content.
Special thanks to our editor, Owen Elphick, who has been a vital member of the Wibbly Wobbly team.
That's all for now. Catch you in the time vortex.